Hey everyone, this is Eric from Barrel and Hatchet, and thank you for checking out another HatchetCast podcast on our Spotify. And this is a very special episode because, one, it's the first episode we've done in a while. We're going to be posting on this platform a lot more, and partway through we'll talk about ways that you guys can support us, but I really want to get into this topic, which today we're going to be talking about the lost trait of masculinity. And so I think the best way to really start this off is to read an excerpt from a book called SOG Codename Dynamite. This is written by Henry Dick Thompson. He was a MACV SOG team leader from the Vietnam War. And so I'm going to go ahead and read an excerpt from his book. As we were flying along, I was enjoying the relatively cool air blowing on me, playing out all the things I had to do during the insertion, reminding myself it was okay to shoot the bad guys, and keeping my anxiety under control. We had climbed to 3,000 feet above ground level, AGL, to avoid the small arms fire that came up at us every few minutes. Some of the bullets were close enough that I could hear the crack as they went by. The sun was getting low. The light was starting to fade. Deck gave the team a 10-minute warning. Another surge of adrenaline. We were just about there. I saw the Cobras slowly coming up next to us and easing on by us, heading for the LZ. Things were about to get exciting. Another quick prayer. I continued to run through what I was supposed to do during the insertion. My right hand gripped my CAR 15 tighter. My thumb was on the safety, rate of fire, selector switch. I saw the crew chief lean over and say something to Sergeant Deck. Deck turned and gave the team a thumbs up, meaning we were going to start our descent in 30 seconds. I could feel the next surge of adrenaline and the accompanying increased heart rate. Conceptually, I understood what was about to happen, but I didn't know the reality of what it was going to be like. I discovered that this happens a lot in war. You are always discovering new realities. Suddenly, the helicopter banked almost 90 degrees to my side, started auto-rotation. The rotor was turning but not grabbing the air, and the four fell out from under me. To say I was not quite prepared for this would be a huge understatement. I was initially just hanging out there in the air, holding onto the side of the aircraft with one hand, looking down 3,000 feet to the ground and thinking, this is not good. My stomach was up in my throat. It was like a thrill ride at the fair, except this was for real. I was trying to hang on and stay with the aircraft as we spiraled downward toward the jungle canopy. Eventually, the pilot got the aircraft to where he wanted to pull out of the spiral and make his short final approach to the LZ. He put the power back on, and we experienced strong G-forces as the aircraft began to vibrate violently and started slowing down fast. When we came out of the spiral, we were on the short final to the LZ. It was a ridgeline where the Air Force had dropped a daisy cutter, a 2,000-pound bomb, to blow a hole in the jungle canopy, just big enough that we could land the helicopter down through the hole. As we approached the LZ on short final, I saw what happened to be a hole in the solid jungle canopy. Must be the LZ, I thought to myself. We were slowly flying over a small pond on the ridgeline when I saw what appeared to be 8 to 10 hooches off to the east side of the ridge in a little valley. Must be a small village, I thought. I didn't remember that being in our mission briefing. Something was not right. Davis and I climbed out on the skid of the helicopter. Quang and Hoa were pushed up against us, ready to jump out. Deck and Cowboy were climbing out on the other side, and Dew was pushing up against them. We were going very slowly, and I felt like a sitting target. An NVA soldier could have thrown a rock and knocked me off the skid at any time. We were slowly approaching the insertion hole, flying with the skids dragging across the jungle canopy. The hole looked small. The aircraft vibrated as we literally dropped straight down into the bomb crater. The pilot was not trying to clip the trees as we were setting down. It was just getting dark. Davis and I were on the skid. We rapidly scanned the jungle air around the crater, but it was too dark and the vegetation was too thick to see into the jungle. Our descent stopped. We were still about 6 feet above the crater floor and were going to have to jump into the bomb crater. I thought it was a long jump carrying 95 pounds of weight. I knew I had to just suck it up and jump. Davis and I bent our knees to jump, and just as we did, I saw an NVA soldier pop up on my right about 10 feet off to the side with an AK-47 pointing directly at me. Instead of jumping, I pushed up and back on the edge of the helicopter floor. Just as I jumped up, the soldier opened fire with his AK-47. The bullets came right across where my legs had been half a second before and hit Davis in the legs. He screamed and yelled, "I'm hit! I'm hit! Help!" As his legs collapsed and he began to fall, the fireball coming out of the AK-47 barrel was blinding and the sound deafening. Simultaneously, the whole jungle lit up all around us and made an unbelievable loud roar as 20 to 30 NVA opened fire on automatic at once. I grabbed the back of Davis's LBE harness and with my left hand used my right hand to put half a magazine, 10 rounds, on full auto into the NVA soldier, who was less than 10 feet away. The impact of the rounds ripped him apart and blood splattered on me as he went down. Aided by adrenaline and cortisol, I managed to jerk Davis up onto the floor of the helicopter. Blood was going everywhere. Then I saw muzzle flashes right in front of me. There was nothing but air between me and the NVA who were shooting at me from 20 to 30 feet away. I was totally exposed. I could be seen. I could be hit. I could be killed. Everyone in the aircraft was returning fire. The two door gunners with their M60 machine guns, 550 rounds per minute each gun, and the team members, two of whom were using me as cover, one firing on each side of my head at 800 rounds a minute each. Their Car 15 muzzles were so close I was getting powder burns from the muzzle flashes. My ears began to go numb, and I knew I was losing my hearing. Hot brass was going all over me and the floor of the helicopter, and the floor on my side was covered with blood that was getting deeper. Hundreds of bullets were coming at us, traveling faster than the speed of sound. I heard them crack as they passed through the cargo compartment or by the helicopter. Some were green tracers. I could actually see them coming out of the dark jungle vegetation and trees. I tried to lean back to present a smaller target. I heard the metallic clangs of bullets hitting the helicopter. Crap, we're going down. Davis was in pain, rolling on the floor and screaming. Blood continued to run out on the floor. I put the other half of the magazine into the muzzle flashes coming from a tree directly in front of me and saw the NVA soldier fall out and hit the ground hard. I heard myself say, "That's two." Now my magazine was empty. We were in a full-fledged ambush now all the way around us. Our two Cobra gunships had opened fire with their miniguns and each firing 4,000 rounds a minute. It looked like two hoses were spraying red water all around us. Every fifth bullet was a tracer, but when they were coming that fast, I could see was red. The bullets were ricocheting off the trees, rocks, and the ground. Friendly bullets were going in all directions. The helicopter vibrated violently as the pilot tried to lift us out of the bomb crater. He had not planned to lift off with all of us still on board. Some of the bullets were hitting the trees and limbs were flying off, and some of the trees were falling. Rocks were being hit, sending fragments flying. Everything was so loud. The second set of Cobras followed right behind the first two, firing miniguns, 4,000 rounds a minute, and 440 Mike grenades at 250 per minute per Cobra. Explosions went off all around us. The air was full of shrapnel, smoke, and the smell of gunpowder and burned JP-4. The team was shooting. The door gunners were shooting. The Cobras were shooting. And the NVA were shooting, determined to take our helicopter down. I was having trouble getting the magazine out of my pouch. It appeared to be stuck, and my fingers were slick with all the blood on them. I finally got a magazine out, then had trouble getting it in the magazine well of my Car 15. I could see hundreds and hundreds of bullets and green NVA tracers coming at the aircraft. I realized that the stress level had caused me to lose most of my fine motor skills, and the bullets were still coming at me. I got the magazine in and re-engaged the enemy. I had a conversation going on in the back of my head while I kept shooting. I am not happy. This is my first mission, and I'm going to die in the first 15 seconds. I've spent 2 years training for this. What kind of deal is this? I came over here to do something. This is crazy. I got another magazine out of the pouch and into my Car 15. I shot at the muzzle flashes in front of me. They would go out after I put a 4- and 5-round burst on them and I saw NVA fall from trees. My magazines were coming out of the pouch and into my Car 15 much easier now and I racked up more kills. I saw tracers and heard screams coming out of the jungle from the wounded and dying NVA. Then suddenly a blast wave followed by a loud boom came across and almost knocked the helicopter into the trees. It was followed by several more with less intensity. All of us in the helicopter were temporarily stunned from the concussion and deafened by the loud explosions. The hooches I had seen on the other side of the ridgeline turned out to be tanks camouflaged with straw, and the A-1 Sky Raiders were dropping 250-pound bombs on them. This added significantly to the noise and the chaos. The A-1s were also receiving anti-aircraft fire, and they engaged those positions too. The pilot was trying to climb out of that little hole in the jungle canopy. At least we were trying to start up, but the helicopter was still taking hits and the Cobras were making more runs. Finally, we actually lifted out of the bomb crater, and as we did, the NVA shifted their fire, following us as we went up. I was learning that the NVA were an incredibly determined enemy. They would not quit. I saw a smoke grenade in the crater spewing red smoke. The red smoke meant there was no more good guys left on the LZ. All aircraft were cleared hot for the LZs as we peeled away from the opening in the canopy. The NVA fire stopped because the Cobra blasted the whole ambush site with rockets, with 17-pound high-explosive warhead, miniguns, and 40-mic grenades. The A-1s came in with the big stuff as the Cobras finished their last run. It was an amazing fireworks show. They destroyed the whole area to include 6 tanks. As we started to fly away, I looked across at Sergeant Deck sitting on the other side. He looked at me with a big grin on his face and gave me an enthusiastic thumbs up. I thought to myself, look at this guy. He is so excited. He thought that was the coolest thing. But man, they almost got us all. It was my first time to experience a level of fear that I didn't know existed. Many times I had tried to imagine what it would be like when people started shooting at me. Of course, I knew I would be a little anxious, but I had no clue. Until I experienced it, there was no way I could even imagine a level of fear like that. Fortunately, I was able to manage the fear so I could still shoot. I did not let the fear stop me from returning fire and doing what I had to do, but it scared me. Having those two weapons right next to my head was brutal. I could tell that my high-frequency hearing was steadily going away permanently, and I was burned from the muzzle flashes. You could get hurt in a lot of ways besides getting hit with rounds. I had killed at least 2 NVA in the first 20 seconds, the guy down below and the first guy in the tree. I knew I'd taken out those 2, and I had hit and killed several other NVA. I saved my first American's life. If Davids had fallen in the crater, he would have been gone. A second later, and we would have both jumped in that crater and been gone. That was bad tactics on the NVA's part. If they had held off 2 or 3 more seconds, they could have gotten all of us and the helicopter. I earned my combat infantryman badge with that action. A whole series of firsts occurred for me during that firefight. A couple of minutes later, as I worked on Davis's legs, I thought about how glad I was that we got out of there. Then I looked down. Several streams of green 51 caliber tracers were coming up at us. Another group of NVA were trying to hit the helicopter. The tracers were bright in the darkness. Fortunately, they did not hit us. I realized that the mission was not over until you got back to FOB 1. I guess that's why I heard people at FOB 1 saying, "Fubai is all right." I told the door gunner to tell the pilot that we had to go straight up to the hospital and drop Davis off. He needed medical attention right away. We dropped him off and flew back to the launch site to drop the team off. Before we went to the debriefing area at the launch site, I asked Sergeant Deck, "I'm just curious, how many magazines did you empty when we were in the crater?" He said, "I emptied 5 and I was working on number 6. I threw 2 frag grenades and a smoke grenade." Then he looked at me and said, "Lieutenant, you need to practice so you get faster at reloading when people are shooting at you or you're going to die." I agreed and said, "Roger that." The quick kill training I had at Fort Bragg really paid off during the ambush. There was no way I could have aimed from the position I was in. That's part of the problem of training. You train to get a good sight picture, sight alignment, squeeze the trigger and hit the target that's not shooting back at you. Then you get in a firefight like this one and your stress level skyrockets. You train to use those sights and suddenly your vision changes, the stress goes up, and you can't see the sights. You can't do it the way you trained. You can't reload the way you trained. Stress changes everything. So if you guys haven't read that book, I'm currently going through this book right now. It's called SOG, codenamed Dynamite. And if you haven't heard Dick Thompson speak, he's been on the Joe Rogan the Jocko podcast and done a couple of interviews there. And I highly recommend, one, listening to his interviews on Jocko, but two, also picking up this book and reading it. There's another book that's a MacVSOG book called Across the Fence. It's written by John Stryker Meyer. Incredible stories, multiple different SOG, MacVSOG members, their stories that are in that book. But what's really interesting about this book so far from Dick Thompson, so SOG codenamed Dynamite, is he was a 1-0, which is a team leader, and he gives a lot of his lessons learned as he was a team leader, which is a really interesting perspective. And in our society today, we are always being told to not be strong, to be in touch with our feelings, to be weak, to let women take charge, to step aside. And there's nothing wrong with women being in positions of authority. But what I'm saying is, you know, men should completely step aside and give up that role because we're buffoons and we don't know what we're doing. Now, the flip side of that coin and the reaction to that type of, you know, societal change in terms of what the roles of strong men are is the far extreme on that, which is like, you know, which actually is truly a man who is toxic, that is encouraged to do these traits to kind of speak back against the, you know, the woke agenda of today, which is go to the gym, drink in bourbon, have a mansion, look out for yourself, be the loudest voice in the room, only looking out for number one. I'm going to the gym just for complete looks. So not for, you know, capability or anything like that. Be a womanizer. How many chicks can you get? You know, being rich, getting money. It's all about me and money. Those are the extreme things that has been a reaction from society saying strong men no longer are needed. Now, what's interesting is those things are good in terms of some of those things as far as the on the far extreme side. Yes, it is good to have wealth because of hard work. You know, it's not bad having a mansion. It's not bad drinking some bourbon here and there. You know, sometimes it requires a strong man to be the loudest voice in the room to speak for what's right. But what I'm talking about is men who are being taught and told and influenced to train their ego to be self-centered and selfish and to look out only for themselves and screw everybody else. You know, there's even podcasts where I think it's the Why podcast, or I can't remember the name of it, but where they interview women who are OnlyFans girls. And there's a lot of really crazy conversations that come out of that podcast, which are good, about how women these days view men and how they want a man who is strong, but at the same time be submissive to their control and let them do whatever they want to do in a relationship. You know, seek other men or dress a certain way and things of that nature. And that has happened because strong, good men have been absent in the family, have been absent in society, have been absent in the communities, or they're just weak men. So what I want to break down today is what does it take and what does it mean to be dangerous? Why is it in movies and shows the heroes that we love to see are like the John Wicks, the hero that is extremely dangerous, but is the quietest voice in the room? His actions and his history speaks for itself. Or like the movie Mr. Nobody, where this dude is just used to be an agent of some sort or in special operations of some sort, has a decorated past, super dangerous, can use anything as a weapon, but he's just like a normal guy is how he appears. Why is it that type of character allures us? Why is it that type of character is attractive to us as men in terms of, I want to be that kind of guy? What does that take? Hollywood has even figured out that that is the kind of hero that is appealing to a lot of men in our society today. Well, let's talk about that. What are the traits of a dangerous man? Let's start off with this first one, which is courage. John Wayne puts it best in this quote, "Courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyways." I think that is very interesting. You know, John Wayne being the manly man of our time, you know, in history, has been always a advocate for strong men in his portrayal in movies. And from what we were told, he was also a pretty wild man himself, but a man who also stood up for things that were right, especially in a place that's evil like Hollywood. And that quote just resonates with me. And I am going to read a passage here from the Bible, and it's a very, very manly verse, which for those of you who are not Christians, the Bible is full of truth. It is the book of truth. And I highly recommend just picking one up and reading some passages in it, because there's a lot of strong warrior men who were in Scripture that you would actually probably be surprised, like, holy smokes, I've never heard that story. And I'm gonna read one of those verses, one of these examples to you. This one is out of 1 Samuel chapter 25. And what's really cool is, let me go back here. So David, King David is a very renowned figure in the Bible. He's in the direct lineage of Jesus, and was Israel's second king in the Old Testament. Now, what is really cool is that King Saul, on many occasions, tried to kill David. And we'll talk about the other trait of being a dangerous man, which is loyalty. And but let's talk about courage. And these are just some of the many stories that are in the Bible that talk about strong warrior men. And so here we go. So Saul is the king of Israel, and he gave David a rank, a very high rank in the army. This pleased all the troop and also Saul's top prime officers. So here we go, 1 Samuel 18, verse 6. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. And as they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." Think about that. Saul has slain his thousand, and David, as a leader of an army and a warrior, has slain his tens of thousands. Like, that's just insane. Like, think about that. In those times, they were using swords and spears and arrows. Like, think about the amount of close combat that that dude experienced and the skill set that he had to have to be able to fight all those battles and win them, which is pretty, insane to think about. Now, there's something else that I want to read to you, and there is also in this passage, and essentially what happened is that Saul was jealous of David, very jealous of David, and so he was sending him on these missions that were almost impossible. And when he would go out on these missions, Saul was hoping that David would get killed because the missions were so dangerous, or the odds were so stacked against David and his warriors that he was like, he'll get killed in battle, and that way I can save face. Well, here you go. Saul gives David a mission saying, "Hey, I will give you my daughter's hand in marriage, but I want you to go and here in verse 24, and Saul's servants told him that David said, Saul replied, "Say to David, the king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies." Yeah, I said that right. Philistine foreskins, 100 of them. Saul's plan was to have David fall by the hands of the Philistines. When the attendants told David these things, he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. So even though David was hated by King Saul, David was so loyal to King Saul that he said he would be honored to be his son-in-law. So David took his men with him and went out and killed not 100 Philistines, 200 Philistines. Talk about overachiever. And brought back their foreskins. So he brought back 200 200 Philistines and took their foreskins and brought them back to King Saul. Talk about a one-upper. And then they counted out the full number to the king so that David might become the king's son-in-law. Then Saul gave him his daughter Michal in marriage. And it says the Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Talk about the courage of that man and his warriors. You know, there's legend has it that even King David, at the time, they called him David's mighty men, went out and were slaying giants. Yeah, you heard me right. In the Bible, it talks about there are giants in that time. Giants. Which, that's a whole nother rabbit hole we can go down. But think about this also. What else does it take to have courage? Not just going into battle, but also doing something that is terrifying. Whether that's, you know, standing up for what you believe in. Whether that's, you know, as Jesus did before he put on the cross. You know that Jesus was so terrified of the cross and dreading it so much that his sweat, he was bleeding, or he was sweating blood. That is how much weight was on Jesus when he was going to go see the cross. But guess what? He was obedient to the Father, God in heaven, and went and became crucified and paid the price for all of the sins of humanity till the dawn, you know, from now until when the Lord comes back. But think about that. The amount of courage to do that. Think about the men in, you know, during the times where everyone is telling them you're wrong, but they stand up and do the right thing, despite what society tells them, or under threat of death or imprisonment. How many strong and brave men do you know in your life who have courage to stand up and do what's right? And then ask yourself, am I courageous? The next thing that we're going to talk about is loyalty. Now, what is loyalty? What does that mean? I think it's something that we today lack as men in our society. Loyalty is being committed to others. You know, loyalty is a funny thing because, well, I'll get into that here in a second, but I'm going to read some things here. There is something wrong. This is a quote from Plato, and he says, there's something wrong with your character if opportunity controls your loyalty. There's something wrong with your character if opportunity controls your loyalty. Here's another one. This is actually from Proverbs 21:21. He who pursues righteousness and loyalty finds life, righteousness, and honor. Proverbs 20, verse 6. Many will say that they are loyal friends, but who can find one who is truly reliable? Is that you? Is that me? Am I that kind of person that is actually truly reliable? If I say I'm going to be there for somebody, am I actually there for them? It's easy to be there and loyal for somebody when things are easy. That's easy. That's not a real true test of your loyalty, though. True loyalty is when the times are tough. Are you going to be there? That's when it matters. John 15:13, there is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. Romans 1:16, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is God's power for the salvation of everyone who believes, of the Jew first and the Greek as well. And this is Proverbs 18:24. There are friends who destroy each other, but a real friend sticks closer than a brother. I want to reference the one verse where it says John 15:13. There is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. You know, in the military, I think there is, I've seen a lot, especially in, you know, you see this in a lot of career fields that are special operations career fields or special warfare career fields. And you see where there's a team aspect, where there are men who are more loyal to their team because of the prospect of self-glorification and glory for oneself, right? But they're more loyal to their team and to their team members and willing to die for them, but their families fall apart and fall to the wayside. They're not loyal to their spouse. They're not loyal to their children and being a good father. Loyalty doesn't go into just one aspect of your life. It needs to be in every aspect of your life. I remember I had a team sergeant one time who had a very decorated past. He was at the 17th and tons of deployments, tons of combat experience, done tons of crazy stuff, had a ton of awards. And I remember he came up to me one time and we were just talking. And he had teenage kids, one of them being his teenage son, was his oldest. And I remember him telling me, my biggest regret is I'm now trying to catch up on lost time. And his son, being 16, he's like, I'm trying to get to know my son. Think about that. His lack of loyalty to his children as a father, because he was more loyal to team members and to a job, caused resentment that he was trying to repair with his own, with his son, his own blood. You have to be loyal in all aspects of your life. First off, we need to be loyal to God, loyal to Him, our Creator. Okay? Second off, being loyal to your family and your marriage. If you are loyal to your friends, but you can't even keep your own house together, then you maybe need to relook at your priorities. God first, then family. Being loyal to your spouse. How many men do you know that are not loyal to their spouse, that are not loyal to their children? May even be having to ask ourselves these questions. Are we truly being loyal to them? Am I making time? Time is something that we never get back. It cannot be bought. You can't rewind things. You know, I am guilty of this and I need to work on it myself. But taking the time, that doesn't mean just standing there when my kids are playing. That means getting off my phone and actually engaging with my children, engaging with my son, listening to him, being loyal to him by giving him my time, which is the most important thing. And honestly, for those of us who have kids, you know, as a father, our children desire our time. Our spouses desire our time. And as strong men, we need to put away distractions and give them that loyalty and be committed to them and making sure that we make the time. I think that's one thing that we as men, especially with all these distractions where every company is vying for your attention and trying to take away your time from the things that really matter. You know, all of these pillars that we're talking about, they intertwine. You need loyalty. And loyalty will cause you to have courage because you're going to be loyal to that friend or that family member and you're going to have the courage to stand up for what is right or to stand up for them. The next thing we're going to talk about is morality. Now, this is something that we have lost. We have definitely lost it in all aspects. Even the church has lost it. Has lost a sense of morality. And you need to have a set of morals that is from an outside source, not from your own brain. Because guess what? Now we live in a society where everybody's morals, you can do whatever you want. Oh, well, my morals are my morals, and that's for me. You do what you want to do. Your truth is your truth, and my truth is my, everybody's truth is truth. No. There is one set of standards. That's the reason why at the Supreme Court, the Ten Commandments are posted up. Why? Because it's a set of standards that has withstood the test of time. It is black and white, and it gives a moral guideline. The Bible is a moral guideline and also is truth. Plato says in this quote, good people do not need laws to tell them to act responsibly, while bad people will always find a way around the laws. Morality can be twisted by society, but the Bible has withstood the test of time and is unchanging. If you are looking for a set of morals and guidelines to help navigate you through life, the Bible is the one that has withstood the test of time. You know that the conscious, everybody has a conscious, and it's not Jiminy Cricket jumping around in your brain. But as Christians, we believe that the Holy Spirit is our conscious. And it's giving you that knowledge of what is right and wrong. And if you are smothering your conscience and you're not listening to that conscience, that voice in the back of your mind giving you that guilt when you do something wrong, and if you make that go away, you constantly do the wrong thing, you push the guilt aside, you continue to do the wrong thing anyways, even though you feel guilty, that conscience becomes numb, and eventually you won't even feel it anymore. And now, right and wrong are blended together, where you can consider wrong to be right because you have ignored and numbed your conscience so much. When you feel guilt, that is a good thing. Listen to it. Listen to that guilt. It is that conscience, is the Holy Spirit trying to tell you, this is wrong, stop, and do what's right. It takes a lot of strength and practice to be able to follow my morals and to be a man of honor. I think morality is a huge pillar and also ties back into, if you actually truly have a set of morals that you stand by, you will have the courage to speak up when someone is doing something wrong, or to defend somebody who is a victim of wrongdoing, a person that you are loyal to. You also can be loyal to your morals. For me as a believer, as a Christian, I am loyal to the Bible and to God. Now, am I perfect at that? No, absolutely not. But it is something that I work towards. And one of my biggest fears is ignoring my conscience enough, ignoring that feeling of guilt when I'm doing something wrong enough, that now that conscience no longer speaks to me, or I no longer feel guilt when I'm doing something wrong. That should be a giant red flag for you. So we need to make sure that we're always heeding our conscience. We're always listening to that feeling of guilt and then acting accordingly. The next pillar is going to be humility and love. Now, humility I'll get to here in a second, but I want to talk about is love. Love is not a feeling. It is not a little bubbly feeling that you get when you watch a love movie with your wife or something that you get. Now, that's a byproduct of love. But love in the definition is an action. It is selflessness, which is why it ties in with humility. Love is the act of doing something for somebody else without anything, expecting anything in return. It is a selfless action. Love is one of those things that ties in with morals. It creates us to be loyal men. It ties in with loyalty, and in turn will cause us to do things that are courageous. As strong men, we love passionately and we love strongly. We love our spouse, loving your children. That does not mean saying I love you, but that means instead of abusing your children, or seeing someone abuse their children, that means guiding them, making sure that they walk by your example. And that takes humility, which we'll get to in a second. But if you are guiding your children because you truly do love them, you're not trying to create a robot, you're not trying to create a clone of yourself, or have expectations that are so ridiculously high that your son or your child can never achieve those things, you need to take a look in the mirror and say, am I doing those things? I know for me as a father, I've put expectations like that on my own son. And the disappointment that I feel because I place expectations on him that are unattainable or not realistic, that is not a loving thing to do.
That is a proud thing to do, to prove that I am still better than he is, when in fact I need to be encouraging him to be better than me. Because I love my son, and I want him to be a strong man who is good, listens to the morality of Scripture, loves the Lord, is passionate about his family, loyal to his wife, loves his family and his wife and his kids. Why? Because he is following that by example. And I want to be the example to him. And I want to emanate the perfect example, which is Jesus Christ. So by instructing him and guiding him and teaching him through example, and the perfect example that I have for that is to be like Jesus, who is perfect, and to then emanate that to my son, that is love. That is me pouring into my son without expecting anything in return. And we need to do this for our kids. We need to do this for our friends and our family. Loving your neighbor as yourself. In society today, we are always told, look out for me. Look out for number one. You're the most important person in the room. Be the loudest voice. Make sure you get what you need. Get yours. Screw everybody else. Literally, that message is the opposite of what we should be striving to be as strong, good men. Loving your neighbor as much as you love yourself. Looking out for somebody who is weak and helpless. Pouring into them. Finding that person that's struggling. And that love will create that loyalty, which in turn creates that courage to do the action that is required to help or change or save someone's life. But we can't have love if we don't have humility. You know, one of those things that I'm always trying to do is kill my ego. You know, there's a lot of, especially, you know, in today's society, a lot of ego stroking, especially in the training community. Let me give you my portfolio, how awesome I am, and all my exploits of my past, and how cool I was, and all the cool things that I did. All that is just ego stroking. There are tons of men who are out there that have had a crazy past, that have done crazy things, but at the end of the day, don't care about you. They care about themselves, and they care about how they look to you. Be the man who is the quiet man, who leads by action, and is continually willing to be humble. Remember, pride comes before the fall. Pride can cause all the other pillars to break in your characteristics as a man. Pride can cause you to be unloyal. Pride can cause you to be unloving. Because if I have pride and I have ego, I have to defend it at all costs. No matter which pillars I knock down, I have to defend my ego at all costs because I care so much about my image and how others perceive me. And trust me, I have to take away and defeat that pride in myself every day. You know, in the Air Force, I was a TACP and still do it part-time. But in the Air Force and even in the Army, the beret is a very strong representation of what you do and your skill level. It holds a lot of weight. In fact, if you go on like an Air Force base and you're a beret holder, like a special warfare airman, like a TACP or PJ or CCT or special reconnaissance, people know what that beret is. And it's like you're a rock star walking around. Or if you're in the Army, you're a Green Beret or a Ranger and you're walking around. People know who you are. They know the type of operator that you are, if you want to say that word, or the type of person and the skill sets that you have. It holds a lot of weight. But what the beret does also, and I've noticed this in myself, and I've had to fight it a lot, and in others, is it becomes a giant ego sponge. identity becomes wrapped up in their beret. And so now you're always trying to defend that ego, defend your skills. Instead of becoming a student who is humble, the beret now becomes something where you look down upon other people who are not beret holders or in different career fields that are not a combat career field. And that creates men who are, in my opinion, not strong men. And I always had to defeat that pride in myself, that I would not talk to somebody differently, that I would not treat someone as lesser than because I had a beret or because of my skills in that job. I had to make sure that I killed my ego. Remember, if I have to kill my ego, that means I am dying to myself every day. Ephesians 4:22-24 says, "You were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness." You know, for those of you who maybe have not heard this story, it's a Bible story, but God, we believe that God is the creator of the universe, that he created all humanity, he created all things. And when Jesus came down to earth, you know that one of the things that he did for his disciples is he washed their feet. The God and creator of the universe washed his disciples' feet. And they were almost shocked. Why? Because he was in a state of humility. God was showing by example because of his love for his disciples, showing them how to be humble, how to put away pride. Think about that. I'd be terrified to have Jesus come down and wash my feet. I mean, you got to think, he is showing the ultimate act of humility, and he is the creator of the entire universe. And we can follow his example by dying to self every day and being humble. I like to say this all the time along with Roy, that I'm a professional student. Even though I'm an instructor in the industry, I like to still say that I'm a professional student. And one of the good things about that is, one, it takes a lot of pressure off because you don't have to defend your ego. Two, humility makes you a better student because now instead of defending my ego, I have room to be able to soak up new knowledge and be in a state of constant learning. Shooting is one of those things where you can always be more fast, you can always be more accurate, and it is a lifelong journey. Like Jerry Mitchell says, you can never be fast, and you never be fast enough, you can never be more accurate. You can always do better. But somebody who has an ego or is using the exploits of their past to be able to be the weight for why they should be instructing has already hit the end of their journey. One, they have nothing more to teach you, and two, they can never soak up new things if they are not, one, willing to learn themselves. Ego must be defeated at all costs if you want to have humility. Remember, if you're having a lot of pride, in the Bible it says that a foolish man is the one who is constantly talking. Make sure when you walk the path of humility that you are the quietest man in the room, but also the most dangerous man in the room. You know, I found out, you know, a lot of the guys that were super legit in special operations that I've heard stories of or have heard of their exploits, they never really say it themselves. They're always the quiet one, the ones that are humble, that are not bragging about their exploits. But I hear about their stories from somebody else. That is, in my opinion, the person who is the most dangerous. The quiet professional. The quiet and humble professional. Whenever we are dangerous, we also want to have skill sets. So that's the dangerous part. Here's the fun stuff. Being the protector and the provider. We have, as men, a desire for adventure. Ever since we were kids, we always wanted a battle to fight. Remember, you always, if you watch your kids out there, if you have sons, they always want to go grab a stick and make it a sword or a machine gun, one of the two. And they're always playing battle in the woods. We all, as men, have this incarnate nature to be able to seek adventure, to find a battle to fight, to find a war to win. And so that also means that if you're going to have some skill sets, this is why we always talk about when the one warrior, one sword method of being well-rounded, being a well-rounded shooter or a well-rounded warrior. So that means if I'm going to be shooting firearms or do things for defense, I need to learn firearms, but also at the same time need to learn, you know, skills with a blade or be able to learn if I shoot running gun, pistol and rifle, I also need to learn some distance. So that way I become a well-rounded warrior. The other thing also is survival and sustainment, being the provider, being able to provide and survive for myself, but at the same time being able to sustain my family. And this goes into teaching my son. I can use these opportunities to teach my kids about these skill sets. So you can use these skill sets as an opportunity to invest in your kids and to spend time with them. The other thing to think about also is your skills maybe off-road. Can you repair a busted tire? Can you get out of a muddy pit if you're stuck in the mud? Can you do some mechanical skills that are basic mechanical things? Can you build things? Can you do electrical work or do some carpentry work to be able to build a house or to put some joists together or to put up some beams? Are you handy with tools? Can you repair things? Like I said, being a capable man means always being well-rounded. And the only way you become well-rounded is by being humble and being a student of all things. Yeah, there's guys out there that have specific skill sets. Trust me, I'm not a mechanic. But guess what? I'm willing to learn. I'm not a construction guy, but I'm willing to be able to learn how to swing a hammer and level things out and make things square. And you only get better by doing those things. I have been blessed, and Roy and I have been blessed, to be able to do the skill of shooting a lot, almost every day. And so it takes discipline to be able to work on those skills. It takes humility to be able to open myself up to new knowledge, to be able to absorb new things. So all of these pillars work together. And so I'm going to challenge you, the listener, the Barrel and Hatchet community member. Are you living by these pillars? Are there certain pillars that you're focused on but not others? Are you not only fast at shooting and no survival skills, but are you preserving your home? Are you loyal to your teammate but unloyal to your wife? Do you have a set of morals that you're standing by and have the courage to be able to speak up when someone is doing something wrong? Or the courage to stand in for someone who is helpless that needs to be defended? Men, we need to be strong to be able to make an impact on our society and our communities and our families. And it starts with you, and it starts in the home. In leading by example. So as we are continuing to strive to be strong men, I will leave this last quote from Plato with you. And that quote is, "The first and the best victory is to conquer self." So today, make sure you go out and you look at yourself and see the deficiencies that we need to work on, myself included. I'm preaching this to myself as well. And strive to be better, to be dangerous and to be men of honor. Thanks again for checking out this episode about being a strong man. Guys, if you want to, please go subscribe to our YouTube channel. And we have a new subscription service where we are able to help us filter through questions that we get. We get so many questions all the time. So this is a way to help filter things. We're also going to be doing a Patreon here soon where we'll have like discounts on classes and events, as well as discount off the store. Another great way to support us is to pick something up off the store and also come train with us. We would love to train with you. It's always amazing to train with Barrow and Hatchet members who are strong men, who are willing to work on themselves and are humble and willing to be able to crush that ego and be able to become more capable. So come train with us and also check out our Instagram for any behind the scenes type things. But guys, it's good to be back on Spotify. We're going to continue posting episodes like this and also interviewing more guests. But make sure that you are going out and training yourself morally, physically, mentally, and being the asset to your family, your friends, your community, and not the liability. We'll see you on the next one.